Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, au nom de l'Université McGill, je vous souhaite la bienvenue à cette révolution tranquille revisitée qui va se dérouler en anglais pour le bénéfice des archives en langue anglaise qui existent à peine aujourd'hui. Le phénomène original ayant été planifié, conduit et raconté par des francophones québécois qui l'ont conçu en leur propre image et l'ont archivé dans sa langue d'origine. Here we are. 50 years later, looking back with a view to recapturing that seminal moment in Quebec's communal history which changed our society so profoundly, so lastingly. As we are able to do so thanks to those revolutionaries of bygone days who were with their colleagues were the architects and the builders of the Quebec we live in today. It's with such great pleasure that we welcome this afternoon these voices of the Quiet Revolution, a group of six organized by the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and the Quebec Studies Program. We welcome them gratefully, both for their achievements half a century ago and for their graciousness in being with us today to remember firsthand the transition from the old to the new Quebec, with the end of the Duplessis era and the election of Jean Lesage's government at the beginning of the 60s, November the 10th of that year, as it turns out. I'd like here to introduce a personal note, which has to do with age. And that's the fact that I was in my early 30s when this all-encompassing phenomenon swept Quebec. Today, people have a tendency to talk about it as coming out of la grande noirceur. But to many Quebecers of my generation, the world was unfolding as it should. There were scores of young Quebecers who had been studying and thinking and planning a modern-day society and even an avant-garde one. And there was now nothing to stop them. I remember Roch Carrier telling me once that Quebec had moved out of the 17th century to enter the 21st, even as we spoke. What was, for instance, with the speed with which the Royal Commission on Education, known ever after as the Parent Commission, generated a Ministry of Education? And how soon afterwards we had UQAM and the CEGEP, and after education came culture, public services, redefining the state, inventing a source of capital funds to invest in the Quebec economy, and begin to build the foundations of the famous slogan, Maître chez nous. As the great social activist Simone Monette Chartrand wrote in her memoirs, de l'ancien au nouveau régime, il y avait tout à créer, à inventer, à structurer, loi, démocratisation des institutions, projet d'avenir, les anciens thèmes de combat étant désuets, épuisés, ennuyants et stériles. Which says it all. À la Simone. Everything needed doing. The Lesage government hit the ground running, thundering as we referred to it then. It was a great, great time, and I'm really looking forward to reliving it again with some of the original cast. But before we do so, I would ask the two people most responsible for organizing this event, Antonia Maione, the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and Pascal Brissette, the interim director of the Quebec Studies Program, to tell us something of the origins and content of today's program. Antonia, Pascal, can you come up for a minute?
Thank you very much, Greta. Good afternoon. Welcome to the McCord Museum. For those of you who have never been here before, or those of you who are old hams, welcome to this wonderful venue and space, and thank you all for being here. Today is a very special day to hear from the voices of the Quiet Revolution. November 10th marks the 50th anniversary of the first throne speech presented by the Équipe du Tonnerre, the Liberal government of Premier Jean Lesage, which would transform both state and society in Quebec. In the 50 years since the 1960 election and that throne speech, historians, academics, politicians, and the general public have vigorously debated the nature of the Quiet Revolution and its impact. Our objective in gathering you all here today looks to the actors involved in those reforms to get their perspectives on these events and shed light on some of the myths and symbols about the Quiet Revolution and how we've lived in Quebec since then. We need a better understanding of the period, which seems increasingly distinct from today's reality, and we need the entire Quebec and Canadian community as part of that conversation. This is the objective and the impetus for today's meeting, to be held in La Langue de Shakespeare, or as my husband's grandfather would say, La Langue Protestante. But ultimately, our goal is to broaden the reflection and on the meaning of the Quiet Revolution. I'd like to thank our partners, Programme d'études sur le Québec, Pascal, and especially my colleague Stéphane Gervais, for spearheading this project with us, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I want to thank also the McCord Museum of Canadian History for being our hosts today, and the Committee on the 50th Anniversary of the Quiet Revolution for their support. I would also like to extend a special merci to Guy Rocher and Yves Martin for helping us as our Équipe de Tonnerre, our brain trust behind the project. Most of all, I would like to thank the participants who agreed to speak today, your many colleagues who supported this endeavor, but for health or other reasons are not able to join you on the stage, to all of you in the audience who are willing to share in our conversation, and especially the McGill students who are here from Canadian Studies. Welcome. Thank you.
J'ajouterai peu de choses à ce que vient de dire Antonia sur les origines de cette journée, ayant moi-même n'ayant pas participé en fait à son organisation, mais prenant le relais en fait tout simplement à titre de directeur intérimaire. Tout le travail à ce titre du programme d'études sur le Québec revient à Stéphane Gervais et au directeur, disons, permanent ou en mandat, Jared Trudy, du programme d'études sur le Québec. Donc j'ajouterai simplement un mot en français à ces voix qui se tiendront dans la langue de Shakespeare. Donc un mot très bref, peut-être sur le programme d'études sur le Québec. Un programme d'études n'est pas tout à fait l'équivalent d'un institut comme celui de l'Institut d'études canadiennes. Il s'agit d'une structure infiniment plus modeste qui est en principe tournée vers la formation des étudiants. Et c'est effectivement ce que fait le programme d'études sur le Québec de McGill. Il offre aux étudiants francophones et anglophones de notre université une mineure et une majeure en études sur le Québec à partir d'une série de cours qui sont donnés, certains en français, d'autres en anglais, par les différents professeurs de la Faculté des arts qui s'intéressent à l'histoire, à la sociologie, à la politique ou à la littérature québécoise. Le programme d'études sur le Québec vise cependant à être un peu plus qu'un programme, comme le montre aussi bien sa participation à l'organisation de cette demi-journée de discussion, mais comme le montre également ce beau volume encore tout chaud, Quebec Questions, tout juste sorti des presses d'Oxford et placé sous la direction scientifique de Stéphane Gervais, encore une fois, et de Jared Trudy, directeur du PEC, que je remplace simplement, je le dis, en raison d'un congé sabbatique bien mérité. Ce collectif Quebec Questions, qui contient 36 articles, dont certains rédigés par des personnes qui sont ici présentes, comme Yvan Lamonde, et qui sera sous peu disponible en librairie, montre assez bien donc le type de tâche que se donne le programme d'études sur le Québec de McGill, c'est-à-dire non seulement favoriser la transmission des connaissances sur le Québec auprès des étudiants par le biais de ces programmes mineurs et majeurs, mais également offrir une contribution à la recherche en cours sur le Québec. Donc c'est à la fois un peu moins qu'un institut, bien entendu, enfin beaucoup moins qu'un institut par sa structure, mais en même temps qui vise à favoriser la transmission des connaissances en créant certains outils vraiment essentiels à l'étude sur le Québec pour les québécistes canadiens et étrangers. Alors, je remercie donc les participants pour s'être déplacés. Je vous souhaite à tous un excellent débat et de bonnes discussions. Merci.
Thank you, Antonio. Merci, Pascal. Now, the first panel, which will deal with state, political, and economic considerations, will be chaired by Kenneth McRoberts, who is now my pleasure to introduce. Professor McRoberts is a professor of political science at York University and has been the principal of Glendon College since 1999. As a scholar, his contribution to such topics as Canadian federalism, Canadian political economy, and mostly Quebec studies is outstanding. In his books like Quebec, Social Change, Political Crisis, Beyond Quebec, Taking Stock of Canada, and Misconceiving Canada, The Struggle for Canadian Unity, have all been important contributions to the field of both Quebec and Canadian studies. In a nutshell, he's one of those individuals who build bridges between the worlds and the works of both Canadian and Quebec scholars and help us to have a deeper understanding of both realities. So, Professor McRoberts, you do the rest of the honors of this panel.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today on what I think will be a very exciting event. I think it's fair to say, several decades later, the Quiet Revolution still stands as a period of profound change, not for lack of attempts over the subsequent years to demystify it, to revise our understanding of it, to deconstruct it, to suggest that, in fact, it was not as significant a period as those who lived it and witnessed it might think. I think we still agree, as a general consensus, that the Quiet Revolution was a period that was very important and that we have to understand and with which we have to continue to come to terms. Certainly the 1960s in general was a period of change in North America and in Europe. It was the arrival of new political leaderships. One thinks of the arrival of John Kennedy in 1960, demographic change that was taking place, emergence of a generation gap. I was part of people who believed that one shouldn't trust anybody over 30 years of age. So these kinds of phenomena were taking place more generally in the 60s. But in the case of Quebec, change seems to have taken a quite particular form. And we can identify several different dimensions of this period. Certainly it was a period in which there was a fundamental revision of the role of the church. It was a period of sexual revolution with a marked decline, dramatic decline in the birth rate. It was the rise of a new nationalism, which transformed the French-Canadian nationalism into a Quebec nationalism. It was a time of crisis in relations between Quebec and the rest of the country, and earnest talk about the need for a new confederation pact. But I think at the center of it all, it was the construction of the modern Quebec state. And that, in many ways, triggered the various other dimensions of the Quiet Revolution. What is remarkable is that this afternoon we have three individuals who played such a central role in the construction of the modern Quebec state. And I think we will get very valuable insight from the discussion that is about to take place. And so I'm pleased to introduce, first of all, Louis Bernard. Louis Bernard holds a PhD in administrative law from the London School of Economics and Political Sciences. He started in 1964 a long career as a civil servant, and during the period of the Quiet Revolution, or more precisely from 1964 to 1970, he was alongside Claude Morin as Associate Deputy Minister for the Ministère des Affaires Intergouvernementales. He further became, in 1976, after the election of the Parti Québécois government, the principal private secretary to Prime Minister René Lévesque, and in 1978 he held the highest post in the Quebec Civil Service, Secretary General to the Executive Council. He kept this position until 1985 and then reassumed it from 1994 to 1995. He also has had a very successful business career with La Laurentienne Bank, where he served as Executive Vice President from 1995 to 1998. He has been since then a consultant for many important dossiers. We can mention the Approche Commune agreement between the Quebec Canadian and Innu people of Mississaugas, Issipit, and Beatsamus. Monsieur Bernard is an officier de l'Ordre National du Québec, and in 1987 he published the book Réflexions sur l'art du gouverner. Monsieur Bernard.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have entitled my presentation, short presentation to you this afternoon, 1964 to 1970, Setting the Play. So let me illustrate the rapid succession of events that took place in the last 6 years of the first decade of the Quiet Revolution by referring to my own story. In 64, I was appointed, as it was mentioned, legal advisor to the newly created Department of Federal Provincial Affairs in Quebec. 3 years later, I was named Assistant Deputy Minister in charge of Canadian Affairs, in the same department, but with a new name, the Department of Intergovernmental Relations, since the department was from that time responsible not only for Canadian affairs, but also for international relations. In 1970, so 3 years later, I left that job to become chief of staff to the parliamentary chief of the newly elected Parti Québécois in the National Assembly. From an expert who had written his PhD thesis at LSE on Canadian federalism, I had become a separatist. The creation of the Department of Federal Provincial Affairs was the brainchild of Prime Minister Jean Lesage, who became its first titular minister. The purpose was to enable Quebec to become a more significant player on the national scene. Rather than being purely defensive, as was the case with the former Union Nationale government, Quebec wanted to pursue an overt policy of actively exercising all its rights to the fullest extent possible. For Mr. Lesage and his colleagues, such an active policy was fully compatible with Canadian federalism and was in no way tainted with any kind of separatist ideology. At first, this policy was largely successful, as it led to the broad agreements of 64, which allowed for the creation of the Quebec Pension Plan, the establishment of the Caisse de dépôt placement, the opting out arrangement with fiscal transfer for a whole series of shared cost programs. That was the time of cooperative federalism and of the acceptance of a special role for Quebec, both in the Canadian Federation and outside our boundaries, with the establishment of Quebec offices in Paris, London, and Brussels. It was also the time of a joint effort by federal and provincial governments to try to lay out together the rules of future fiscal relations between the two levels of government through the work of a joint tax structure committee, which discussed new tax sharing arrangements and proposed the establishment of a new equalization and stabilization program, which has survived to this day and has even been constitutionalized in 1982. Not unexpectedly, this movement towards a greater role for the provinces and a special and even greater role for Quebec engendered resistance in Ottawa. Pierre Trudeau, who was then Minister of Justice, made an alliance with the then Minister of Finance, Mr. Sharp, to scuttle this trend and revert to a more traditional unilateral federalism. And in Quebec, at the same time, the Union Nationale of Daniel Johnson came back to power and replaced the Liberals of Jean Lesage. Those events signaled the end of cooperative federalism and, in response, the beginning of a search for a constitutional rather than an administrative solution to federal-provincial disputes. Having received a resounding no to its fiscal demand of repatriating 100% of personal income tax, 100% of corporate income tax, and 100% of inheritance tax, those we call direct taxes, the Johnson government started to put the emphasis on the need to review the Constitution in order to reaffirm and reinforce the powers of the provinces. That was in line with a recent book authored by Mr. Johnson entitled Égalité ou Indépendance. At first, Ottawa refused, but Ontario, under the leadership of John Robarts, organized the Confederation for Tomorrow conference, which led Mr. Pearson finally to accept the opening of a first round of constitutional discussions. And from thereafter, for many years, all governments became involved in a long effort to reorganize the Canadian Federation. Ironically, this exercise was to end much later and through multiple peripeties, I looked for an English translation of peripeties, and I couldn't find any, with the patriation of the Constitution in 1892 and a loss of power by the Quebec government. Meanwhile, in Quebec, the idea of secession was on the rise. From the electoral slogan of Maître Chénault in 62 to the creation of separatist parties, Alliance Québec, ARN, ARN, to the Vive le Québec Libre of General de Gaulle in 67, to the creation of the Parti Québécois by René Lévesque in 68, the Question Nationale became a central piece of Quebec and Canadian politics for the years to come. And at the general election of June 1970, the Parti Québécois entered the National Assembly with 7 members and 25% of the votes. Thus, in those short 6 years, 64 to 70, we have seen the emergence of the 3 major trends which would inspire the various efforts made since that date to solve the Quebec-Canada conundrum, or from a Cuban point of view, the question nationale. First, the administrative solution. Through the progressive evolution of administrative arrangement, Quebec would see its power grow and it would assume new responsibilities with the other province, which the other province may or may not exercise, as was the case for the pension plan, the student plan, the opting out of share cost program, immigration, recruitment and integration, manpower training, etc. This approach, this administrative approach, is still used occasionally today, but special arrangements with Quebec are increasingly viewed with disfavor by the rest of Canada. Secondly, the constitutional solution through new constitutional arrangement. That was the purpose of the Meech Lake Accord and of the Charlottetown Accord, and as you know, both failed. And thirdly, the secession solution with or without a trade and monetary union with Canada, and that was the purpose of the 1980 and 1985 referenda, and again, both failed. So 50 years later, it is easy to see that the Quiet Revolution was based on a strong urge of Quebecers to be responsible for themselves, to set their own agenda, to take their own decision in all spheres of their lives, social, religious, cultural, economic, and political. In the sphere of Quebec politics, the main turning point was a change in the collective identity of its citizens. From Canadien-Français, they became Québécois. That fundamental change came naturally as they realized that the only instrument that they had at their disposal to achieve their fundamental goals was the Quebec government and the Quebec state. Revolutions last only a few years, but their effects are long-lasting. French and American revolutions happened some 20 years ago, more than 200 years ago, but we still live with some of their consequences. And it's the same with our own Quiet Revolution. The Question Nationale is still with us, and it is still unresolved. Asymmetrical federalism, or reformed federalism, or sovereignty association are still in competition as the best way to end that play that was set in place in the 60s. Sorry. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, monsieur. Now that Mr. Bernard has set the general setting, federal provincial setting in which the Quiet Revolution took place, we can now turn to the first of the major reforms of the Quiet Revolution, namely education. And I will introduce someone who was very closely associated with those reforms, namely Guy Rocher. After completing his studies at the Faculté de Sciences Sociales de l'Université Laval, where many indeed of the actors of the Quiet Revolution were trained, Guy Rocher completed his PhD at Harvard University under the supervision of sociologist Talcott Parsons. It's not frequently one refers to Talcott Parsons these days. He became in 1958 director of the École de Service Social at Université Laval. In 1960, he started his long career at l'Université de Montréal as professor of sociology, and from 1979 till now as a member of the Centre de Recherche en Droit Public. During the period of the Quiet Revolution, he was a member of the Perron Commission that made proposition proposals to restructure the Quebec school system. He was also at two different times deputy minister from 1976 to 1978 of Développement Culturel and 1981 to 1982 to Développement Social. He received over his academic career many awards, such as the Prix Marcel Vincent, the Prix Léon Gérin, le Prix Molson, and le Prix William Davidson of the Royal Society. His book, Introduction à la Sociologie Générale, has been translated into many languages and is still today a classic reference for students in sociology departments around the world. A book called Guy Rocher, Entretien, was published this year under the direction of his nephew, political scientist François Rocher of l'Université d'Ottawa. Guy Rocher.
Good afternoon. In 1960, Quebec had the very best educational system, the best educational system, the worst educational system altogether. Quebec had the very best educational system for the English-speaking Protestants. They were the most educated group probably in the world at that time. Quebec had the best educational system for a small, very small segment of the French-speaking population, which could attend the famous 51 of the famous 50 classical colleges that were all over the province, and then attend university. Quebec had the worst educational system for the rest of the French-speaking population. And this was a drama because in 1961, we realized, according to the last census, Canadian census, that Quebec population was the least educated of all Canada. And in Quebec, the French Canadians were the least educated of all. So it was clear at the end of the 50s that our educational system was in a great need of restructuring, as you said, or reshaping. In 1958, members of the Liberal Party introduced in the electoral platform of the Liberal Party the promise that, be elected, the Liberal Party would create a commission of inquiry to explore the situation of the educational system in Quebec and to make recommendations to the government. In 1960, the Liberal Party was elected in June 60, and in 1961, the Royal Commission of Inquiry on Education in the province of Quebec was created by the Lesage government. And as has just been said, I was appointed as one member of that commission. That commission worked for 5 years, from April 61 to March 66. Its report was divided into three parts. One was published in 63, the other in 64, and the last in 66. One very exceptional feature of that Royal Commission is that most of its recommendations have been rapidly adopted and implemented by the Quebec government at that time. It's one of the rare commissions that has not worked for nothing. It's a very special case in the history of Canada, and I would say in the British, of all the British Empire. I will just emphasize some of the recommendations, three at least of the recommendations of the Panel Commission, which have been implemented and which are part of the patrimoine of the Quiet Revolution. The objective of the Panel Commission was to democratize the educational system, democratize in several senses. One of them was to give to the political power the authority over the whole educational system. Previously, before 1964, the educational system was in the hands mostly, or even completely, in the hands of the Catholic clergy, from primary school to university. And the Protestant system was in the hands of what I would call private interests at that time. The two systems were completely independent from one another. There was no higher authority over the two, and they ignored each other completely. So there was a need for the unification of the social, of the educational system. The first recommendation in 1963, made by the Panel Commission, was to create a department, a Ministry of Education. And this recommendation was rapidly implemented by the Lesage government, as you know. It's in May, I think, the 16th of May, 13th of May, 13th of May, when Yves Martin joined the department, that the Ministry of Education was created with Mr. Paul Genet Lajoie as the first Minister of Education. The objective of the Department of Education was first to unify the educational system, to unify it under a single authority of a minister of a department, and the second objective was to create new institutions that could be more democratized than the old elitist system. It is interesting to note here that the Department of Education in 1964 was the first Quebec department, Quebec ministry, that was rationalized in a way. And it was the first department that where a new leadership was recruited as civil servants among university professors, among sociologists, demographers, historians, economists. One very strange, important change that took place with the Department of Education was that the all authority over the public education was transferred from the hands of the clergy, of the bishops especially, to the hands of the Minister of Education. Because before 1964, the 22 bishops of Quebec had full authority over primary schools, secondary schools, high schools, normal schools where teachers were trained, as well as they have large authority over the classical colleges and the university. After 1964, the bishops had lost all their authority, in spite of the fact that in the opinion of a large proportion of Canada, Quebec was still a priest-ridden province. The second great change that took place after 1964 has been the creation of the CEGEP, the Collège d'enseignement général et professionnel, which are being created with the material and personnel resources of the Collège classique and of the École normale, and which were created as a fusion of pre-university programs and professional programs. And that was the originality of this new institution is to be an integration of pre-university programs and technical or professional programs. And the CEGEP have been created very rapidly in 1967, starting in 1967, 68, 69. And there is here an interesting moment of the history of Quebec because, as you know, the Liberal Party lost the election in 1966, right after receiving the third and last part of the Panama Commission. And we could think at that time that that was the end of the reforms because the Liberal Party had been identified with the reforms, but the Union Nationale had been identified mostly with the conservative part of the population. But after the election in 1967, the Union Nationale, headed by Daniel Johnson, the father, decided to go on with the reforms. And it is under the government of the Union Nationale that the CEGEPs have been created and that the Université du Québec have been created. And this vast operation took 3 or 4 years, I would say, but they were fundamental in the history of education in Quebec. Thanks to the CEGEP, thanks to the Université du Québec, more and more French-Canadian boys and girls could attend high school and post-secondary institutions. The girls have been especially beneficiaries, the French-Canadian girls, because before 1960, the French-Canadian girls were underprivileged in our system. The system was built up mostly for boys. In 1960, girls were the problem. In 2010, boys are our problem. What a change. Another important change that took place in the 60s was the process toward a non-sectarian educational system. Before 1964, the old system was sectarian. It was sectarian by the Canadian Constitution itself. The rights of the Protestants and the Catholics were protected by the Canadian Constitution of the time, here in Quebec as well as in the rest of Canada. It took almost 50 years to go over this deconfessionalisation of the old system. But it started in 1964. It started in 1964 because the Department of Education, the new Ministry of Education, was created as a non-religious political institution. It started in 1967-68 because the CEGEP have been created as non-denominational institutions. The Université du Québec has been created as a public institution which was no more denominational. And what is significant here of the Quiet Revolution is that the CEGEP have been created, as I told you a moment ago, with the resources, the human resources of the Collège Classique and the École Normale, which were all denominational and sectarian. So most of the personnel, almost all the personnel of the Collège Classique, which were religious, which were clergymen, which were nuns, accepted to enter a new institution which was non-denominational. And I would say that this was especially difficult for nuns because they knew for sure that no nun would become the head of a CEGEP. They knew for sure that no woman would become the head of a CEGEP. But they accepted the challenge to enter the CEGEP as professor, as teachers. behind those changes, there was a driving force which I can summarize as the intelligentsia of the French-Canadian community. I mean by that university professors of that time, college professors, college teachers, journalists, writers, artists, who were becoming conscious of the need for a restructuring of our educational system, who were more and more critical of the collusion between the clergy and the politicians, who were becoming more and more conscious of the underfunding of our educational system. And I can say that this intelligentsia was to be found in several institutions, newspapers, in university, colleges, but also in the media at that time. Two federal institutions have been important, Radio-Canada and the National Film Board, which were invested by probably separatists, new young separatists maybe, but especially by young intellectuals who provided the personnel for Radio-Canada and the National Film Board. And of course, institutions like the Faculté des Sciences Sociales at Laval University was one of the institutions that was most instrumental in the changes to come. In conclusion, all I can say is that, to me, the education reform is one of the main element of the so-called Quiet Revolution. It's one of the main elements because, thanks to the changes that took place, more and more French Canadians were educated. More and more French Canadians entered business, entered new industry. More and more French Canadians became higher servants. And I think that with the change in the educational system, what we witnessed was a change in the hierarchy of power between English-speaking and French-speaking Québécois. Merci.
Merci, Monsieur Rocher. And now I call upon our third speaker, Claude Fastonguay, who was educated at l'Université Laval as well as the University of Manitoba, where he completed his actuarial studies. He returned to Laval, where he taught from 1951 to 1958, and after the election of the Lesage government in 1960, he was named a member of the Comité interministériel d'études sur le régime de rente du Québec that had to make that established proposals to create the Quebec pension plan. Mr. Castonguay had an influence over the choice of the capitalization approach adopted for the plan, and it was a particular contribution that he made that was to have major consequences. From 1960 to 1970, he served as chair of the Commission Royale d'Enquête sur la Santé et le Bien-être Social, which proposed the establishment of a provincial health insurance scheme. And from 1970 to 1973, was Ministre de Santé and Ministre des Affaires Sociales in the Bourassa government. He was president of subsequently of the Groupe La Laurentienne. He was made an officier de l'Ordre National du Québec and a companion de l'Ordre du Canada, and served as a senator in the 1990s. He has received degrees, honorary degrees, from many universities, but I would like to mention one in particular, which is York University, the Glendon campus of which awarded him an honorary degree in 1999. Mr. Castonguay.
Bonjour. My presentation this afternoon will be a little more personal than what Louis Bernard had to say and Guy Rocher. I just want to describe my role in the establishment of the Quebec Pension Plan and the creation of the Caisse de dépôt, which was rendered possible by the funds accumulated under the Quebec Pension Plan. I was very interested when I studied to become an actuary in social insurances. I was conscious of the fact that after the First World War, the events that led to the depression at the end of the 20s and the 30s had to be avoided after the Second World War. And during the Second World War, Churchill, who was Prime Minister of Great Britain, had established a commission to prepare the policies that could be adopted after the war to give some hope to the British people, but also to make sure that the economy would not behave as it did after the First World War. And social insurances were seen as a major component, as a major element in that connection. The Beveridge Report was the major contributor to what we now call social democracy in countries like Canada, Great Britain, Australia, etc., as far as social insurances are concerned, by distributing the wealth, redistributing the wealth, preventing its too great accumulation by just a small group of individuals or big corporations, and also by stabilizing the economy with the purchasing power that was given through social insurance to the population at large. In the early 60s, after the establishment of the hospital insurance plan by the Lesage government at the beginning of 1961, the attention moved to the question of pensions. The elderly population in Quebec and in the rest of the country was living under very difficult conditions. Poverty was widespread among the elderly, and for that reason, the question of pensions became an issue. It was seen the old age pension system that had been established a few years before was not seen as being sufficient to provide elderly people or retired people with a necessary level of income. And at the same time as this debate was taking place in Quebec, the Lesage government and all the people involved in public affairs thinking about ways of making sure that the Quebec French-speaking Quebecers would have some control over their economy. The idea of creating a Caisse de dépôt et placement had surfaced and was being discussed. It was a nice concept, except that there was no evident sources of fund to create such a Caisse de dépôt. But then I, with other people, saw the link between the creation of a Quebec pension plan and the accumulation of funds and the funds necessary to create La Caisse de dépôt. And this is how, in 63, I was among, we were just a few actuaries in Quebec. I wrote a letter, having been interested in this type of question, I wrote a letter directly to the Premier, Monsieur Lesage, offering my services, and I asked him to meet with him and tell him how I felt that this question could be handled. So a few days I saw his secretary, René Arthur, who had been my teacher at l'Académie du Québec, and I asked him, I said, the only thing I'm asking you is to put my letter in front of Monsieur Lesage so that he can read it. And he did. And I got a call a few days later, and I was asked to meet Monsieur Lesage. I was 34 at the time. I was an optimist, and I felt that I could do something in connection with that project of establishing a pension plan in Quebec. Well, I had a good discussion with him, and he said, okay, you go ahead and you work with, there was a small task force that had been accumulating documentation on that issue, and he said, you work with them and you design what you think should be a pension plan for Quebec workers. So I set to work, and we had very little means at the time, no computers, not very much good information, solid data, but with what was available, we produced a report at the in February of 64, after about a year of work. A very intense work, and this happened at the most appropriate moment. There was a federal provincial conference that was to be held in Quebec City, in the National Assembly, actually, and the new federal government, or the new government under Lester Pearson, had among its projects the creation of a Canada pension plan, a pension plan for the whole country. So I was invited. Our project was discussed by the cabinet in Quebec, and the reaction was good. So I was asked to attend the meeting as a consultant, and during the conference, after the Canada pension plan had been described by Prime Minister Pearson, Lesage asked him, as chairman of the conference, if he could present his own plan. And so that was a little of a surprise for Pearson and company. But the other provinces, the premiers around the table, said yes, he should. So Lesage described our project, and obviously the reaction around the table was a very positive one. It was so positive that at one point, Pearson, who had a good sense of humor, asked if they could join the Quebec pension plan. So, the conference was dealing with other issues, and obviously the pension question, there was no agreement reached. The question was just put aside for the time being. And there were other issues, fairly important ones, like the fiscal arrangements, to which I think Louis has made a reference. And the conference ended without any solution to any of the questions that had been discussed. In the following few days, some communications were established between the Pearson and Lesage government, and it was seen that if a solution to the Quebec, to the pension question could be reached, it might enable it might help to resolve the other questions. So I was asked by Lesage to go to Ottawa with Claude Morin and meet a small team over there to discuss, to see if we could arrive at an arrangement. So in Ottawa, we met with the chief of staff of Pearson, Tom Kent, Maurice Sauvé, who was the minister at the time, the equivalent, anyway, to the senior minister for the province of Quebec, and the deputy minister of social welfare. So things were not as they are today. There were no big committees and task force. We just met with them on a Saturday on a very confidential basis. And we discussed for a full day. And toward the end of the afternoon, the federal government was proposing a Canada-wide plan to which there could be some special features to apply in Quebec. And we felt that this was not satisfactory. The question of pensions was under the jurisdiction of provinces, and Quebec, in that connection, should have its own plan. And it was entitled to, and there was no way we could agree to what was being proposed. So finally, we had the opportunity to make a proposal. We proposed that there would be two plans, one for Quebec, one for the other provinces. And we also made sure that this plan, the plan that would be established, had to be funded in advance. No question of just paying the pensions out of current revenues. And this proved, actually, to be a very wise decision. Today, countries that function under the pay-as-you-go system, let's say, are all in having big problems, while countries like Canada or Quebec, with their fully funded pension plans, can face the situation with the aging of the population. So the this proposal was finally agreed by Ken Sauvé and Willard, and presented to the to Pearson and eventually to the cabinet. And in Quebec, the same thing. We presented the plan, what we had discussed, to Monsieur Lesage and the cabinet, and finally to the National Assembly. And the agreement on at both levels and with the other provinces was accepted. It was seen as a major step or victory in the concept of cooperative federalism. And the importance of that event was related also to the fact that it could enable the government to create La Caisse de dépôt. And La Caisse de dépôt, the legislation was tabled a few months later, and when the Quebec Pension Plan took effect on the 1st of January 1966, La Caisse de dépôt was being created and started to invest the funds that were being accumulated under the Quebec Pension Plan. And I think that La Caisse de dépôt has been seen as a major element in the let's say transformation of the Quebec economy, in the power that it gave to the government over its public finances, its power, its ability to borrow funds for such development as the hydroelectric power, for example. It was seen also as a, at the time, but for a limited period of time, as the recognition that Quebec was a distinct society, was unable to establish its own legislation and programs over issues dealing with social and policies. And this did not last very long, but it was seen as a major event, and it may inspire, if ever the question is being discussed again, it may inspire both sides in showing that this sort of thing is possible. Merci.
Ask a question. It's a rather general question. we've been asked to think in terms of what were the forces that led to the Quiet Revolution and what were the forces that resisted it. And Mr. Rocher talked about the importance of the intelligentsia. I must say, it must have been an exciting time. If a 34-year-old could write a letter to the Premier saying, I have some ideas that I think would be helpful, the Premier meets you, puts you on a committee, and then you end up at a federal provincial conference, and it must have been a very heady experience. So it would be a great time to be part of the intelligentsia, however we want to define it. And I guess the question would be whether the other two of you agree that this was a primary force. But were there other forces? What about organized labor? Did organized labor play a role in leading the Lesage government and perhaps Lesage himself into reforms that he wouldn't perhaps have originally anticipated? And then I guess the other side would be, well, what were the forces of resistance? Where would resistance to these reforms have been located? And in the case of education, I presume the church was a restraining force, but maybe not a overtly restraining force. In the case of Mr. Castonguay and Mr. Bernard, you've referred to the federal government, and I'm thinking about Mr. Bernard's presentation in particular, because you indicated the original response, at least by the mid-60s under Pearson, was one of trying to find some way of accommodating these pressures from Quebec. Is it possible, because, and then you say ultimately, what, 40 years later, we have three different routes, none of which is actually being followed. Could we have imagined that, in fact, the more accommodating approach of the Pearson era might have continued under different leadership at the federal level? And if that had happened, would, in fact, have there been some sort of accommodation of the pressures coming from Quebec? There was a pretty radical change under new leadership, but to put a fine point on it, I was at the Liberal Convention in 1968 that chose Trudeau. Robert Winters could have won that. Yeah. It was pretty close.
Yeah.
There's that famous clip where Julie LaMarche is trying to get Paul Hellyer to withdraw and says, come on, Paul, you're still young. You can come out. You can support Winters, and don't let that bastard win, who was Trudeau. So it was relatively close. So if, in fact, Winters had won and that kind of leadership had remained at the federal level, could we have had quite a different outcome and an accommodation of some of these forces? So I guess that really was a series of questions that each of you can
I'll try to answer rapidly. First, that was a tremendous time. When I came in, you know, in 64, I came from University of London and so on. I was well educated and so on. But, you know, at that time I was working directly with the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister was my minister. And I worked with Louis-Philippe Pigeon, which was the top legal advisor to the government and so on. So that was very exciting. Yeah. You know, we had everything to build. So we were we had nothing against us in the government itself.
Within the government.
We had no resistance at all. We were building. To your second question, I am quite positive that cooperative federalism could have worked. There was some real deception within the federal government civil service at that time that we could not continue on the cooperative approach. There were some people in the civil service at that time, coming from Saskatchewan in particular, that were quite open to a new arrangement whereby there would be more flexibility and more cooperation, both in fiscal and economic things. And we were very much disappointed that this trend did not succeed. And this was through the personal efforts by Pierre Trudeau and by Mr. Sharp. Well, I know that they tried to really embark their colleagues in the cabinet and so on, and in speeches in the rest of Canada and so on, saying we must block that because it might lead to separation of Quebec or too much decentralization in Canada. They believed in their ideology. I'm not saying that they were deceitful, but I mean it really stopped this difficult trend to more decentralized federalism. And this is, if I take my own experience, I was a convinced federalist at that time. You know, that was my field of expertise, and we worked very, very hard to develop new means of cooperation between the two levels of government. But when we were stopped by Trudeau, I just said, well, that's the end of it.
Mr. Christopher.
Well, I think it's interesting when we look back to see how some individuals can play a major role in events like this. For example, at the end of 1959, Paul Sauvé, who had just succeeded to Maurice Duplessis, died a sudden death. And people, I believe, agree with the fact that if he had lived, he would probably have defeated Lesage in the following year, and that the events that took place, would have taken a very different form. There would have been profound changes, but not necessarily exactly in the same form, at the same rate that they did under Lesage. Later, 12, 13 years later, the Trudeau government went into an election and was re-elected as a minority government. The Conservatives were short of two seats to defeat the Liberals. They were under Robert Stanfield. And if the Conservatives had won that election, I'm sure that Stanfield and the Conservatives would have been much more accommodating and would have had a much better understanding of the situation as far as the Quebec question was concerned. So it's interesting to see how individuals, general movement that gave rise to the Quiet Revolution is one thing, but the role, the significance of the role that individuals can play and the turn of event, the turn that events can take place.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Boucher?
Well, as far as education was concerned, there were more driving forces than I mentioned in my expose. For instance, the youth movement was very important at that time, and especially the student movement. And I still remember that the Fédération Générale des Étudiants de l'Université de Montréal, which Bernard Landry and Pierre Marois presented a very progressive memoir to the Commission Parent, to the Parent Commission. They proposed to have non-confessional universities and public universities. They were too progressive for a large proportion of the Quebec population at that time. But there were also resistant forces. I would say that most of the nationalist French-Canadian movement was conservative at the time and rather reluctant to the changes that were taking place. Except the independentist movement that was progressive. And I must say that the long Protestant community was also resistant largely because we could understand them. They had lived with us complete autonomy for more than a century. And now, starting in 1964, they will be under the authority, the community would fall under the authority of the Minister of Education. And the chance was, of course, that this Minister of Education would be a French-Canadian for a long time. I remember my colleagues at McGill very resistant to this idea and saying, after all, McGill is not a Quebec university. McGill is an international university. And why should McGill fall under the Minister of Education? We know that the Liberal Party lost the 1966 election because it was said at the time that the Liberal Party had made too many reforms, and that was why he lost the election. I've never known to what extent this explanation was true or not. That has been longly discussed at the time. Paul Gérin Lajoie was especially pointed as one responsible for too many reforms. But the public opinion was such that, as I said, the Union Nationale taking the power made the changes that had been proposed. They made the changes because Johnson, Premier Johnson, was convinced, but mostly because Daniel Johnson was knew what public opinion was. He listened to the public opinion. I think that's one reason why he went on with the changes.
Where was organized labor in all this? Was it a major force in propelling the government towards reforms?
The labor movement had changed rapidly in the 50s. The Catholic movement, labor movement, had changed with a new leadership at the time. A new leadership, which was mostly coming from the Faculty of Social Sciences at Laval, a leadership which was kind of intelligentsia, strangely enough, and the Catholic labor movement became very conscious of the educational problem, especially for the labor class, for the working class, and. I remember that the CPCC, as it was called, created the Collège des Travailleurs, which was very active at the time. It was a Collège des Travailleurs for the members of the labor union. This Collège des Travailleurs organized lectures and courses in Quebec City first, and then in several cities where they had members. And I've been traveling at the time with the Collège des Travailleurs, giving lectures on the sociology of social classes in Quebec and things of that sort. It was a very active and influential college, des Travailleurs, at the time.
I myself. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Gaston.
Well, on this question, on the other side, when we worked on the development of the Quebec pension plan on account of the Caisse de dépôt, the establishment, the financial establishment, and the big corporations were very much against that, and they put a lot of pressure on the government, on Lesage and his cabinet. They saw the creation of La Caisse de dépôt as a means to free the government from and the large trust companies and the banks who control the borrowing by the government for its projects. And so their reaction and the pressure they put was intense, and some of the members in the cabinet were not very favorable to the idea of creating La Caisse de dépôt. The leader among that group was George Marler, who was the equivalent to the Minister of Finance now, and some other people. The most active member of the cabinet in favor of the creation of the Quebec Pension Plan and La Caisse de dépôt was René Lévesque. Mm-hmm. Actually, he followed our work through André Marie, senior civil servant, to make sure that we would stay, we would not deviate from the proper direction that he could see. So it was a difficult period to go through, but finally the results, I think, when we look back, were very good.
And so far as the labor movement is concerned, it was not a driving force for the beginning of the Quiet Revolution. Part of it was international. You know, with FTQ, as we know it, it didn't exist at that time, and the CSN was more of a Catholic, social Catholic approach and so on, so it was not really political as such. It was more social than political. And but they were soon to realize that it wasn't their advantage to be behind. So they came as a second wave, I would say, saying that, well, it's a good thing that we have a civil service because these are members to recruit there and so on. So they became quite in favor of the Quiet Revolution, but they were not a driving force at the beginning, I don't think so.
So we can identify several major reforms that were constituted the Quiet Revolution, but the sense I got from Mr. Rocher is that there could have been a Union National government if Paul Sauvé had lived that would have been in power in the 60s. And even under Jean Lesage, was there any kind of strategy that was developed, a general plan, or was it more a case of ministers and deputy ministers having their pet projects and their clientels and promoting them and pushing them, as in the case of the nationalization of the hydroelectrical firms, and the ostensible head of the Équipe de Tonnerre was sort of brought along?
Well, I may tell you another little story that shows that it was not a very well organized and clearly planified program, let's say. When Daniel Johnson was elected in 66, a few weeks after his election, there was a general strike among hospital employees, and that created a very difficult situation, and actually the government had to put under trusteeship all the hospitals, and that was fine as far as solving the strike question, but there were a lot of problems that remained and facing the government with respect to health, and what was obvious that would come, the creation of Medicare or the coverage of doctors' fees, the establishment of the health system. So Johnson, who had a small majority, a fairly weak cabinet, had to face all these questions, and he met with most of the senior civil servants, and I was invited to meet with him, although I was not a civil servant, I was a consultant. And he asked me what I thought he should do, and I said, you should create a royal commission. That's the best way to avoid having to react to all sorts of problems to which you're not prepared. Transfer them to the commission. That commission will gather the necessary information, will make some proposals, will probably have a role in informing the population. I said, that's a good idea. He said, would you add such a commission? I said, I was very confident at the time, less so now. I said, yes, I would. So a few months later, the commission was created, and we worked for 3 years producing our report.
It was a very opportunistic movement, Quiet Revolution. We had so many things to change that when there were some forces of change in one place that could do something, we were behind them. You know, that's a wave that goes where the land is a little bit lower, so the waves comes in and so on. So that was a very opportunistic, within that general framework that we should become master in our own house. We should take our own decisions and so on. That was the urge, I think, in every sphere of Quebec. But there was no general plan, as you would imagine, for instance, in a socialist society when you try to plan the overall development and so on. That was not an organized revolution. I don't think there's anything like an organized revolution. I think a revolution is a more general and diffuse movement than otherwise.
Because Charles Sykes did promise in 1960 during the campaign that there wouldn't be a Ministry of Education.
Well, he didn't say so. He said, no, he said, we will... He didn't promise the department. He promised the commission.
The commission, but no, nothing else. That was all about all.
Was against the department.
Yeah, more, that's what the newspaper said. Mr. Lassalle was against anything, but for everything that worked.
There was no general strategy, as you said, and that's right. There were several reforms, but I think there was a network of what I would call intellectuals.
Yeah.
And I think that was the source of the Quiet Revolution, what I call the network of intellectuals. I use the word intellectual as a broad category, but let's say educated people, professionals and... people in universities, in the labor unions, and in the youth movements. And it's this network that has been very active in various fields and who have been the agents of the reforms. People like Claude Castonguay and Bernard and people like Pierre Perrault, for instance, the filmmaker, the great filmmaker, who has used the National Film Board as the basis for all his work. And Pierre Perrault is part of that Quiet Revolution, too, to me, as well as many other writers and artists at that time. So that's what I call network of intellectuals.
You ask about the labor movement. At that time, the relationship between the labor movement and the government and its role, the question was far from very clear. At one point, Lesage even declared, because the government employees were trying to negotiate with the government, and they were putting pressure. At one point, Monsieur Lesage declared that the Queen does not negotiate with its subjects. So shows
that was
some issues were not very clear in people's minds.
That was a really funny declaration. It shows that Mr. Lassalle was a person of another time, but he did. He was a major actor in the Quiet Revolution because he was able to change his mind. He was able to listen to people and change his mind. You know, you could argue with Mr. Lesage, and you could resist Mr. Lesage. I have many instances where he wanted me to say something, and I said no. And he was quite grateful to me that I had said no because he was... Yes, that's right. So he was a great personnel, Mr. Levesque.
So you were allowed to speak truth to power. You could.
Oh yes.
You could speak openly.
Oh yes, he wanted. He wanted that. Right? We were brought, you know, quite. You went to him and spoke to him and so on, and you could. He would level with you. Provided he was a little bit higher.
If you had to pick the one greatest success and one greatest failure of the Quiet Revolution of these reforms, what would you pick?
To me, the failure is the growing place of the private sector in education.
Yeah.
It's a big mistake on the French side. It's a big mistake because... Because of the growing place that the private sector has taken, all the good students are selected in the private schools, and the public system is crippled by the concurrence, the competition of the private sector. And to me, it's one explanation of the décrochage,
dropout. Primarily boy dropouts,
especially in high school.
Yeah.
And it's also, to me, the explanation, one explanation for the fact that the Quebec is the last province, is the province where the adult population has less access to university. Mm. So I think it's a very, very big mistake.
The success would also be education.
Education, we all agree.
So education would be the biggest success and the biggest failure?
Yes, definitely. We should come back to a more democratic systems and to revalorize the public system.
Mr. Custer,
at the same time, even putting that aside, the reform de l'éducation was the biggest, the best achievement of the Révolution Tranquille. Because without the reform of education, the other things would not have been possible.
It's true. Both are true.
Mr. Bernard?
Yeah, I agree with that. The education, because the education is a long-term investment. And if you put your money in that kind of investment, and it is well invested, and so on. This is where you get the highest return. So there's no doubt that the education is the major success. The failure, I don't see a big major failure. I think there are many small failures. The failures of, for instance, it's true that the government has a major role. But the citizens, too, must play their part. You know, in Quebec, when you have a problem, the first reaction is to turn yourself towards the government and say, I have a problem, solve it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, sometimes it's the case, but not all the time. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is a failure of... which is the reverse of the success of the public. This equilibrium between the efforts by the community, by the persons themselves, and so on, as apart from the government, is a failure. In the management of things, I think we haven't yet succeeded in managing our very good health system. We have one of the best health system in the world, but it is not the best managed system. So we must, there is a failure of management there, which is important. So we have many I would say, failures, maybe not failures, small things that we did not succeed yet.
I could keep on asking questions. This is such a wonderful opportunity, but I think I should give an opportunity to people that
will make sure that they get the microphone.
Okay.
Before people speak.
Wait, Mr. Fortier? Mr. Fortier?
I have one question and one point to make. The first question is, you're all men, but in the early 1960s, there was one act to streamline the status of women, the legal status of women. I mean, women in Quebec didn't have any status before the Church and Cascadian Act of, I think it's 1962. Was that a major, considered at the time as a major achievement, and what were the consequences of it? My second, the second point I would like to raise is, I think the Quiet Revolution has been a big success. It's not entirely true that the Quiet Revolution was a sort of Brownian movement that is going here and there, day after day, you do this and you do that without any plan behind. Of course, if you're in a specific department and you work on a specific issue, there are these kinds of random walks. But if you look at the 1962 budget speech of Premier Lesage, I think those guys were at the time trying to make sense of what they were at. And the objective was very clearly specified that what we want to achieve is to make sure that the 80% of the Quebec population that is French gets to the right place it should have in this province, one. Second, that there should be an educational revolution. Third, that economic development should be catching up with Ontario. And third, it should be an equalitarian society. We should try to reduce inequalities in society. In other words, the three objectives were education, economic growth, and the fight against inequality. And those have been three big successes of the Quiet Revolution. Educationally, we have the highest median level of schooling of the entire country, with Ontario, on par with Ontario. In income per head, and perhaps I can anticipate what Mr. Landry is going to say, we are again on par with Ontario. In terms of income per capita, we're 94% of Ontario, but we love so much leisure time that we renounce to some of that income. But basically, if you measure the standard of living well, we're on par with Ontario. And third, we have the least unequal society of all of North America. And those three successes are very big to me. The cost is, I think, I think the cost is exactly as Louis mentioned, that is, managing this big, we have the largest state government or provincial government of the entire North America, of all the 60 state or provincial governments. And of course, with the bigger government comes bigger problems, because there are always government, always problems of managing government.
Would you like to respond to
this? Just a word about women. I myself think that the women in Quebec were the first revolutionaries, because they resisted the church about the family planning. You know, that was a real break between the women of Quebec and the clergy, because they told the clergy, you won't tell us how to behave in our own families and so on, and they made their own choice. And this, I think, made the Quiet Revolution possible, because the power of the church everywhere in the world relied very much on the women. But they couldn't do that in Quebec because the women had lost faith in the men managing the church and so on. And to me, they were the first to resist the existing state of things. Much even the, in the year, much, you know, the, at the end of the 50s that started. And to me, this is a very important development in Quebec society, and it proved very important. And from there on, you know, they have succeeded in taking their place in our society, and it's not finished. I mean, the girls will run Quebec in a few years, I'm quite sure, because they are more, much more sharp and dedicated to work and so on than the men.
I'm the father of four daughters, and they were the revolutionary in my family, too.
Well, you're a revolutionary.
But last week, I was teaching a class of third-year undergraduate students in law. And I had 55 students in front of me. 50 were female, five were male. So I told them, the future is in your hands, as you just said, Louis. You women, you will be the judges, you will be the premiers, you will be the prime minister of this country. In 1944, when I was a student in law, it was exactly the reverse. We were 50 boys and 5 girls. So that's the change in Catherine Quebec.
Did you have a question? Okay, there's a question over here.
My name is Sam Tota. I would like to make 2-3 comments. The first one, I find this a very long revolution. I went through a revolution. It only lasted 24 hours. It was a military revolution. So that's the first point. The second point, when you speak about this revolution, you have to define it, because during the past 4 decades, we had many changes in many societies. So this society went through specific changes. You have to tell us what were those specific changes and whether you really reached the end. In my opinion, respectfully, I say you failed in the revolution. Not for the French fact. In the French fact, yes, you gained. But in other look at it, you failed. For example, Mr. Castle, you mentioned the financial institutions. There were a problem when you mentioned during the pension reforms. We still have them as a problem. That has not been solved, the financial institutions' strength. The other point, the point of immigration, for example, majorly you failed, because you brought many immigrants here. And instead of selling or showing the province of Quebec, the beauty of the province of Quebec, it has 100,000 lakes,
1 million.
You just showed
1 million.
1 million, sorry, I stand to be corrected. In Israel, there are only 2 lakes, one is salty and the other one is water. And so the point I'm trying to make, without taking too much time, is that you have so many assets in Quebec, and those assets have not been shown to the public. And from that point of view, you just centered your revolution, you call it revolution, it's a very long revolution, on certain points, education and language and things, but there were other points that, in my opinion, you didn't work through. So, thank you.
I'd like to make a comment. If the revolution in Quebec had been shorter, there would probably have been violence. And if it took longer, it was because it was a democratic acceleration of change, and people gave it the name of quiet revolution. It was not a true revolution, but an acceleration of change, and I think that this was much preferable to a short, violent revolution, in my opinion.
I would add that you don't build a prosper and interesting society through revolution. revolution is a short space of time where you do things on plan that you put to the extreme in a way and so on, and you do it as best as you can. And that's what we've done in the 60s, because we had a lot of things to change at the same time, just to get at par with the neighboring societies and so on. So we had to go through that revolutionary, accelerated change period. Okay, that's what we call the revolution in the sense that everything was done at the same time without too much planning. But you don't govern and administer a society that way. I'm not asking for a permanent revolution in Quebec. And I know we have problems with management, we have problems that are common to all governments, and this government is not the government in the world. We have problems and so on. So when you say succeed, what is success for a society? Is there a society where it is full success? I don't think so. Look at the United States now. You should say, well, they haven't succeeded in their American Revolution. What's the American dream now, and so on. So I think it's not the good way to assess the Quiet Revolution. The Quiet Revolution is what took place in a short while of time when Quebec tried to do everything at the same time. Mm-hmm. And on the whole, I think it was, for that period, it was a success.
We have time for two short questions. There's one. Excuse me. I recognize somebody here, and we have a student. So could I ask each of you to ask your questions, and then the panelists could respond to the two of them in turn?
Actually, my question is more about what was the rest of Canada thinking while Quebec was doing all this? Saskatchewan does have socialist ideals as well, starting with the NDP in the 50s, but while Quebec was having this crazy transformation, the pension plan, you mentioned that the rest of Canada liked what was going on. But yet, no other province has adopted something like the University of Quebec. No other province has adopted the CEGEP system. Obviously, no other province had the intense control of the church, and very few provinces have national desires like Quebec. My question is more, what was the rest of Canada thinking while Quebec was having such a rapid transformation?
Well, I have a short answer. We were quite popular at that time, in the rest of Canada, because I was speaking to the rest of Canada, other provinces and so on. From the 64 to, almost the end of the 70s, Quebec, everybody was happy that Quebec would come with modern ideas and so on, wanted to have development and so on. It's only later on that they became more frightful with that movement.
Maybe we hear the other question here, and then we do the microphone over here, and then...
I'm allergic to microphones, so can I hold it, please? All right. Thank you. My name is Caroline Jandol. I actually come originally from Manitoba, and when the Quiet Revolution was underway, it was very quiet for me because it was in my pre-awareness days. However, I'm an educator and a thinker, and I've been thinking about the problem of the dropout in education because I've worked here in the system, in the trenches. As I was saying, I was very pleased to hear Monsieur Rocher identify education as being one of the great failures. It's a major conundrum, and in my view, it's still a problem, partly because of the paternalistic attitude. When I hear people like Monsieur Charest say, it's the parents, fault. It reminds me of a very weak response. Because the other day when I was writing a letter to the editor, I identified that the roots of this, I don't pronounce it very well, but the dropout situation really lies in the in that period of Quiet Revolution. So I'm pleased to hear that you agree. But it's a whole set of issues of the way the society changed. And of a lot of role models and the disintegration of society and the number of people who live in single family, not single family, but single individual. So people are not taking responsibility. And I wonder if you could comment on that, because I really think that that is one of the stories. Consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have two questions, and I could ask, presume we start with Mr. Gaucher.
Pourquoi
ça persiste? Why is dropout, why is décrochage from schools a very important phenomenon in Quebec?
In Alberta, it's the highest in Canada, not in Quebec.
Okay.
It's everywhere. First of all, the figures on dropouts are very difficult to interpret, because there are much more raccrocheurs than we can include in the statistics, in a way. The Quebec educational system can absorb the raccrocheur much more easily, I think, than some other, because of the flexibility of the École Polyvalente and the Cégep. So I think we must be cautious when we talk about the statistic of the dropouts. But unhappily, as I said a moment ago, it's in the public system that the dropouts are most numerous, and I think the public system lacks the stimulation of the good students who are selected by the private sector. And that's one weakness of the public system, of the high school especially. And that, to me, in my opinion, is one explanation that we don't, that we're afraid to put before the public opinion for the number of dropouts. Mm.
Mr. Castanet?
Yeah. You want to answer that?
Well, I think we're running out of time, so I think we'll have to move to Mr. Castanet.
I have nothing to add to what Mr. Castanet said.
The other question was about how the rest of Canada reacted to the quiet, what was going on in Quebec.
Well, I think that Louis made a good answer to that one. The big reaction against Quebec was really within the federal government. The civil servants and the federal government were much against what was happening, and the liberals under Monsieur Trudeau also. But as far as the population was concerned, I think that as a whole, the reaction was positive. People saw Quebec really getting in
modern times,
in step with the rest of the country.
Is it better?
That's right.
Well, for somebody who's been studying Quebec for more years than I would want to acknowledge, this has been a wonderful opportunity, but I think it's also been a wonderful opportunity for the audience. So I want to thank each of you for this afternoon for your thoughts.
Nous revenons à 30 minutes, nous revenons à 3h30 pour le deuxième panneau. Ça va? Est-ce qu'on devrait? Il y a un café et puis des biscuits, des friandises d'or. Bon.